leadership has led Iran into.
Thank you, sir. Please, Bonnie, go to the next caller.
Thank you. Caller, you may introduce yourself when you hear your line is unmuted. Oh, sorry, that person.
No longer there?
No longer there, so just bear with me 1 second. We'll go to our next caller. Okay, here we go.
Yes, hello, my name is Ken Leiter. My question is, I've read recently that both Germany and France are planning to do an end run around the current U.S. Sanctions against Iran. And I was wondering if what your assessment of their efforts will be.
Well, they have been mainly talking about three things. You know, the first thing is that they want to create a parallel system of banking clearance, parallel to the SWIFT system. I don't know whether you are familiar with the SWIFT system or not, so that Iran could have access to its income from oil exports. They have contacted three countries so far, Austria, Luxembourg, and Belgium, to accept to host this system, and all three of them have refused. So for the time being, they can't find anybody in the European Union to host this system, which is not clear how it is going to be set up anyway. So it is mainly talk. The second thing they have promised is to apply the mechanisms they already have for import-export trade with the outside world in the case of Iran. For example, the Germans have a system called Hermes, the French have a system called COFAS, the Italians have their own system, which means that if an Italian or a French or a German firm exports things to Iran and Iran cannot pay, the government will compensate the exporters. These have been suspended all for the time being. They were resumed for a while under pressure from President Obama, but now they are again in suspensions, and there is a promise by Ms. Federica Mogherini, who is the in charge of the European Union's foreign policy, to revive these things. But there is strong opposition to applying these facilities to Iran inside the political elites and parliaments, you know, and the public opinion in all European countries. I don't know whether it can happen or not. The third mechanism that Ms. Mogherini has taught is to give Iran access to a special drawing rights on some banks, some European banks, especially in Austria, that do not trade or they don't have much trade with the United States. So they won't face punishment by the U.S. One major Austrian bank had come forward to do that, but now they have withdrawn because the government in Austria has changed. The pro-Iran government has been replaced by a new coalition that is not very hot on the Islamic Republic. And another Italian bank that was also about, you know, to assume that role has withdrawn. So we are left with one bank in Cyprus and two banks in Turkey, which is not a member of the European Union. So I don't think any of these measures will amount to much. The only thing, my impression is that the European Union is trying to persuade Iran to not to formally denounce this nuclear deal and continue observing it. In any case, Iran has no choice but to do that because it doesn't have the wherewithal to adopt another completely different policy on this issue. And the Europeans have no policy of their own on Iran. So they are just, you know, it's as if, you know, if you don't know where you are going, you just park your car and wait to see what happens. This is the present situation with the European Union.
Thank you, Mr. Tahiri. We're approaching 1:30, and we still have quite a few callers who would love to ask you a question, but I don't want to impose on your time if you don't have some extra time for us. Are you able to take any more questions?
Yes, let's have, now that we are in it, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. All right, Bonnie, please go to the next caller.
Okay, caller, please go ahead when you hear your line is unmuted.
Thank you very much. This is Nissan Buri from New York City. I'm trying to understand to what degree the sanctions efficacy will work and whether it's geared towards the leadership, the IRGC and the religious leadership, or towards the people of Iran, who in turn will increase the protestation against the regime. Which way do you expect it to go, and how long will it take until some serious impact is achieved? Thank you.
Well, you know, the sanctions don't affect the Iranian ordinary people directly, because they don't cover such things as food or medicine or humanitarian things and so on. And in any case, you know, Iran has a continental-style economy, which means, you know, it is almost self-sufficient in food. It imports around 11% to 12% of its food, including, incidentally, the soya beans that the U.S. Cannot sell to China now, Iran is buying them right now. So that will not lead to famine or things like that in Iran. And the Iranian, ordinary Iranian will not be, will not go hungry or without medical attention and so on. But it will affect every Iranian, because the economy is shrinking, and the government, the public sector, they cannot pay the wages of people. You know, in some cases, workers have not been paid for 18 months. So it is not really directly related to sanctions, because the sanctions haven't started to bite again. It is the whole situation that is causing that. It is the sanctions will not directly affect the leadership, the IRGC, the exporting of revolution, and the mullahs in charge and so on, because they have priority. If a single dollar comes, of course, the priority is to spend it in Syria, in Lebanon, in propaganda, and also on the mullahs in the country, and on the preservation of the regime. So, of course, in the medium term, the ordinary Iranians will suffer because of that as well. Because if the cake as a whole shrinks, the share of the people will also shrink. But as I mentioned a few minutes before, the important thing is that this regime must be defeated politically. And in that context, the outside world, the United States, the European powers, China and Russia, countries that matter in the Iranian political horizon, have a very important role to play. Unfortunately, all of them, all these countries that I mentioned, still follow the, in my opinion, the impossible dream of achieving some change of behavior by the Islamic regime rather than regime change as such. And the Islamic leadership knows how to play with that. If their back is really to the wall, if the knife is reaching their bones, they will say, okay, let's make a deal, as they did, you know, with Obama. They make a tactical retreat, but their strategy will not change. This is the situation at the moment, and We have seen it in many, many ways. For example, the Great Britain severed its relations, diplomatic relations, with the Islamic Republic after a mob attacked the British embassy and ransacked it in Tehran. But at that time, the British closed the official Iranian embassy in London, but allowed the unofficial Iranian embassy, which goes under the name of a special representation of the Supreme Guide, they allowed it to continue to function. In the United States, we don't have an Iranian embassy, but we have representatives of the Supreme Guide operating in the United States. We have duality of Iran. Iran as a state gets hit. Iran as a revolution is welcomed. So this is the outside powers should consider. And inside Iran, too, people should be persuaded that there is no mechanism for reforming this system. It's not the fault of anybody, any particular leader or group of leaders. This system simply doesn't work, you know, and there are regimes in history that don't have a mechanism for reform. Many Iranian opposition figures and groups are beginning to subscribe to this idea, not sufficient number yet, but the narrative inside Iran is changing towards a change of regime, and I hope this will also happen outside Iran.
Thank you. We'll go to our next caller.
Thank you.
Ben Farahi from Reno. Professor, I'm Iranian descent, also proud American. Do you think it's in the best interest of Western world, especially Europe, to have a regime change in Iran or to have this regime contained?
Well, it depends, you know, what length of time we are talking about. You know, the best case scenario for the Western world is to have Iran return to the international fold as a normal nation state. The other day in London, the day before yesterday, in fact, we had a seminar at the Westminster University in London about Iran, a plan B. And the plan B we talked about was helping Iran to become a nation state again. Because if Iran becomes a nation state, it is the last big market left outside the global economy. It could be a market of $1 trillion. It is at the center of a potential market of over 400 million people. So it would be good for Europe, it would be good for the United States, it would be good for Russia, it would be good for everybody. At the same time, Iran is involved in all the conflicts in the Middle East now, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in the situation in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Pakistani Balochistan, in Afghanistan, all over the place. So if Iran becomes a normal law-abiding nation, looking after its national interests rather than its revolutionary aspirations, it would be good for solving all these problems as well. So it is in the interests of the Western world or the Western democracies to nudge Iran, persuade Iran, or pressure Iran, or force Iran to gradually absorb its revolutionary experience and become an ordinary nation state, which might be not a very delicious nation state, but it would be a normal one. Like, for example, the People's Republic of China, you know, you don't want to invite their leaders to dinner. They are not maybe frequentable, but nevertheless, you know, they are not your enemies. They are not going to kill you. They are not going to seize you as hostages. They are not going to do terrorism in your capitals and so on. They are an adversary. You know, you can deal with an adversary, but when the Islamic leadership says the United States is our enemy, the word Dushman means, you know, somebody whom you have to kill. You know, because we have nine different words in Persian to denote, you know, the degree of opposition, the opponent, the adversary, the rival, and so on. And when they go for the worst possible word describing not only the United States and Israel, but also some Muslim countries and some European countries as enemy or foe, you know, or hostis in Latin, if you want the Latin equivalent. This is the problem. So the whole world has a keen interest, a real interest in seeing Iran come back to normality, and Iran cannot come back to normality as long as this revolutionary elite follows it. Today, for example, General Hajizadeh, who is one of the IRGC generals, he said that the Islamic Revolution is not confined to the borders of Iran. It has to conquer the whole world. 2 days ago, Dr. Hassan Abbasi, the chief theoretician of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, they call him Kissinger of Islam, said that the United States must convert to Islam eventually, otherwise we'll continue to fight it. You know, with this kind of childish or maniacal discourse, how could you expect the European Union to persuade the mullahs in Tehran to start, behaving in an acceptable way? The sooner the outside world realizes that Iran's problem will not be solved with tinkering and with tactical behavior change, I think the better for everybody.
Thank you. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Okay. All right, we'll go to our next caller.
This is Peter Weinstein. Your exposition of the steps which can be taken is most impressive. But I have a very, very simple question. Where do you see the condition of Iran being 2 years from now?
Well, you call that a simple question.
The answer is difficult, but the question is simple.
Yes, this is, you know, the simple questions are usually the most complicated ones. You know, as although I come from the Middle East, I don't have the gift of prophecy. I'm just, you know, a journalist, and I can analyze what I see now. What happens in 2 years' time, it's difficult to say. But, you know, I can only tell you that the trend is towards chaos in Iran. And this makes me sad. You know, I want Iran to come out of its present ordeal in an orderly way, with the least possible damage to itself and to its neighbors. But at the moment, three factors are of great concern to me. The first is that the leadership of the Islamic Republic itself is losing its grip on the country. This, in the long run, is good. In the short run, it could be very bad, because if nobody can control anything, then you will have chaos. And you have seen several examples of this with the Supreme Guide, Ali Khamenei, Ayatollah Khamenei, who has really full power, theoretically, but we have seen many examples in the past year or so that even he cannot impose his views all the time. For example, he issued two fatwas banning women from riding bicycles and ordered the Islamic security to severely deal with women who ride bicycles. The Islamic security and police, they made some shenanigans to escape it, and there was just one incident. They arrested two women riding bicycles in the city of Yazd, but then they dropped the whole thing, and they said, you know, that over 3 million Iranian women ride their bicycles to work every day, so the whole thing was forgotten. Then the Supreme Guide ordered that Iranian universities be purged of all humanities coming from the West. So they organize a week-long seminar how to make Islamic sociology, Islamic economics, Islamic history, you know, in everything with an Islamic source. The president spoke there, the chief philosopher of the regime spoke there, lots of intellectuals and so on, but in the end they decided it can't be done. So we just forgot about it. The Supreme Guide said that if Trump denounces the nuclear deal, I will burn it. But he hasn't burned it, and he can't burn it. So, you know, this could lead to a situation in which that the regime itself cannot take its acts together, even on issues that of interest to itself. This is the first cause of concern. The second cause of concern is that what we have seen in recent times in the form of people power, which, and there is now people power in Iran. We had demonstrations for over a month, over last Christmas, in more than 120 cities. My fear is that without leadership and without a coherent strategy, they could go to the same way that the so-called Arab Spring went, which released a lot of popular energy, but then wasted it. And now we see that all the forces of reaction in the Arab world, they came back and crushed the Arab Spring. My third problem is that some countries, including some of our neighbors, want really to disintegrate Iran. They think Iran is too big, you know, it should be like the former Yugoslavia, and the smaller Iran would be better. So they are helping and arming secessionist groups. There are, for example, 80 such armed groups stationed in Pakistan, in our southeast. The Turks are trying to encourage secessionism among Iranians who speak Turkish. The Russians are plotting both ways, you know, flirting with the regime, but at the same time plotting against it. So, you know, these are the concerns that unless we manage to control the situation somehow and create an opposition force legitimate enough and strong enough to chaperone the nation in this difficult situation, we are going to have very, very difficult and complicated 2 years ahead. So that's a complicated answer to your simple question.
Excellent. Thank you, Bonnie. Go ahead to the next person.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Bill Seltzer in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I'm very interested in the military since the country you're describing is plagued with poor management in all areas and the bad economy and corruption. Just how much of a threat is their military to Israel in particular, my interest, but in all of countries without any military, it's very hard for them to make any strides in international trade, etc. And the other issue is the vested interest represented by their nuclear investment, I think is possibly still alive. They get paid a lot of money just not to do anything. So I ask about those two situations.
Yeah, as far as the military is concerned, you know, we have, as I said, we have two of everything. We have two governments. We have two forms of justice. You know, we have Islamic revolutionary courts. We have the ordinary courts inherited from the previous regime. On the military side also, we have the classical army, the national army, which is a professional military force. American trained with American doctrinal background, mostly American weapons inherited from the past, and its leaders clearly state that their task is not to export the revolution, but to defend the borders of the country. But of course, you know, they have been the Cinderella of the regime, because the regime has invested most of its military budget on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, which was created after the revolution by Ayatollah Khomeini. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard itself is not a monolithic organization. It is several different chunks. You know, there is the mobilization of the dispossessed, which is, you know, the mass of the troops. There is the officers corps of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, around 30,000 people. Then there are the veterans of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards. Then there are various ad hoc organizations. There is the Jerusalem or Quds Corps, which is the vanguard of exporting the revolution. There is the Karbala Brigade, which is there to crush protests and so on. But since, you know, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard is faulty in design, because it's not clear whether it is an army, whether it's a police force, whether it's a security organization, it has not succeeded in developing an esprit de corps. And at the same time, because it's divided into five separate commands, its commanders cannot coordinate their own work, because they can contact each other only through the leader's office. It's very complicated. So they have an important role to play inside the country, because they are also involved in lots of businesses, lots of investments, and lots of public corporations, and so on. Recently, there has been an attempt at creating a bit of coordination by the Supreme Guide, creating a kind of committee of generals. We have 12 major generals, which is the highest rank in the Iranian military. Of these 12, 7 are from the Islamic Revolutionary Guards and 5 are from the National Army. But the influence of the National Army or the classical army is on the increase, because of the 7 Revolutionary Guard generals, only 3 of them are active generals. The others are retired. Whereas on the classical army side, they are all active generals. And for the first time, we have a member of the classical army appointed as defense minister. This is a brigadier general who has been appointed as defense minister for the first time. And also for the first time, the deputy chief of staff or general chief of staff is from the classical army. So there is a return of the national army. More importantly, last week the Supreme Guide asked the national army or the classical army to take over the protection of Iran's eastern borders from the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, which has been performing very poorly. As you know, there was a recent attack on one of their border posts on Pakistan. The border guards were kidnapped by terrorists who came from Pakistan and so on. And before that, you have had dozens of attacks via the Afghan and Pakistani borders. So now the army is going to take over that. My guess is that the next move would be also to let the army protect the frontiers with Turkey and Iraq. So the classical military is making a comeback. Now what its significance will be, I don't know, but I think it's a welcome trend away from Iran as a revolution and towards Iran as a nation state.
Excellent.
As for the nuclear, no, it's just a nuclear thing. You know, the Iran has the scientific know-how and the industrial base to do, make nuclear warheads even now. And President Obama knew it, but he implicitly accepted it. The only thing is that the decision to make these warheads has not been taken, And with the dire economic situation at the moment, they are not in a position to do that, especially that they would need a mechanism for carrying these nuclear warheads, and that costs a lot of money, which is for the time being excluded.
Fine, thank you. All right, we'll go to the next caller. Thank you, Bonnie.
Okay. Go ahead, caller. Go ahead, please. Is your line muted?
Oops. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Hi, it's Mark Epstein, Miami. Quick question. How much can we believe the economic data that you were providing? I just think back to back in the Cold War in Russia and the lack of really any ability to trust or have a real firm understanding of the Russian or economy back in the day. Where's the data coming from, and can it really be believed? How can we really know what the economy is or isn't really going through when all is said and done?
Well, first of all, you know, Iran is not like the Soviet Union because it's not a monolithic system. There are different factions and different interests fighting each other. And the data that we have, there are three sources of this. First, you know, the official sources, the Central Bank of Iran, the Minister of Economy, the Minister of Commerce, to a certain extent other ministries, Ministry of Agriculture, Energy, and so on, the National Iranian Oil Company. So, you know, there is a lot of data that comes from these sources, and in most of these sources we also have whistleblowers, because don't forget that we live in an age, it's not like, you know, the Cold War and the Soviet Union, you know, and the total silence. You know, it's very difficult to keep secrets. So, you know, from official side, we get a lot of information, in fact, too much information. Of course, you know, if you know the situation, if you know what you are looking for, you know, it's not easy to deceive you. The second source of information is from private businesses in Iran, from the chambers of commerce, for example, and of industry. We have special chambers of commerce and industries in the case of 22 countries, each separately. So they hold their sessions, they publish their studies about the situation in Iran, and sometimes they even call in ministers. For example, recently the Tehran Chamber of Commerce called in Mr. Zarif, the foreign minister or foreign secretary, and grilled him in a very serious way. I saw the footage of this grilling, which was supposed to be in secret. So, you know, everything was overboard. There are debates in the Islamic Parliament, and we must not assume that all the 290 members of the present parliament are 100% with this regime. Some of them dream of an Iran as a nation state. Some of them dream of Iran as a vehicle for revolution. So they also reveal things every now and then, not always. It's not a genuine parliament in the Western sense of the term. But nevertheless, you cannot totally write it off as, for example, the Chinese parliament or the Soviet parliament in its time. It has a little bit more leeway. Then there are the Iranian people themselves. You know, I can tell you that the Iranians are the most politically aware people in the Middle East at the moment. You know, we have over 4,000 NGOs in Iran. Over 25 million Iranians are on the internet. You have so many bloggers. You have so many chat rooms. There are 8 million Iranians in exile who are in contact with their relatives in Iran. So there is some mechanism for finding out what happens. When it comes to reports on Iranian economy by the World Bank, for example, or the International Monetary Fund, I'm more cautious because they base their reports on information officially supplied to them by the Iranian government, which is they have to do that for all their member countries, you know. And since Iran does not allow them to do genuine research inside the country, so sometimes their numbers are suspect. Another way of finding out is the statistics of countries that trade with Iran. For example, China yesterday, the Chinese Ministry of Energy showed that their imports from of Iranian oil has decreased by 75%. You know, this is an official Chinese figure. China is the biggest importer of Iranian oil. Now, why is it happening? It seems that, you know, the Saudis, the Americans, and so on are offering China cheaper oil or giving them a better deal. So there are lots and lots of sources to check, but in the end, you have to verify, or, you know, trust but verify. And this is what we try to do as much as possible.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Tahiri, we have three final questions in the queue. We've reached the top of the hour. You let
okay,
me know.
Okay, let's do them quickly. And
okay, and then we'll finish up. Okay, go ahead to the next caller.
Okay.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes. Mr. Tahiri, first let me say that has been an absolute pleasure and a great education to read you over the years, both your articles and your books.
Thank you.
And a lot of the themes that I wanted to ask you about, you have touched on from the questions of the prior callers. However, I do want to ask this. As far as your information sources are concerned, the debate within Iran itself regarding the type of shape and structure of the next possible government, should this government indeed fall at some point, is there any appetite in Iran for the return of the monarchy?
Is that the only question, or?
Well, I mean, I do have one more follow-up, which is how
okay,
likely...
Okay, no, let's start with the monarchy. You know, because Iranians are really unhappy now. There is no doubt about it. You know, I see that in our poetry, our novels, our films, and so on. Recently, I gave a lecture in London about modern novel, you know, post-revolutionary novels in Iran. And I reviewed the 200 best-selling novels that have been published in the past 40 years, that I've read them over the years. And all of them are touched by nostalgia. Because, and this is normal, you know, you can see, you have seen it in other countries that have gone through a revolutionary experience. You can see it in China, in the post-communist Russia, in all over the place. Even in France after the revolution, you know, there was a feeling of sorrow for the golden past, which was there or which was not there, but you imagined it. And recently, an old Persian word from one of our poets, Nezami, who was in the 14th century, has found new currency in Iran. The word is Fosusan, which means nostalgia. So we no longer use the French word nostalgie or nostalgia as we did before. We have our own word. And when that feeling of nostalgia is there, of course, there is an audience for the previous regime, the good old times, or the French, as they called it, la belle époque. So There is a constituency for monarchy in Iran, but the problem is that the standard bearer of monarchy, the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, himself does not want to enter the foray, if you like, as a pretender to the throne. He says, I'm just a Democrat, I'm a politician like everybody else, we are going to have a referendum, and so on. But the theme of royal Iran, the monarchy's Iran, is very, very powerful in our poetry and culture nowadays, you know, because when you are uncertain, if you are uncertain in a situation, you always look to the past to hang on to something. And this is not your, you know, only in Iran, anywhere, you know, at the times of crisis, you go for sure values that you know. But at the right now, this potential political capital is not being used very actively as a political force inside Iran.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go to our next, to our last caller. Please introduce, Bonnie.
Thank you, caller. Go ahead when you hear your line has been unmuted.
Hello, this is Linda Caro. Thank you so much for coming today. My question is related to the resistance to sanctions. And as you described, China's interest seems to be purely economic. But what about Russia? What is their interest in resisting?
Well, Russia is also, I think, resisting in word. You know, first of all, China owes Iran $22 billion in unpaid oil revenues, that they have bought oil from Iran, they haven't paid it. And they say, we cannot pay you in dollars because of American sanctions, so why don't you buy Chinese goods? And the Iranians don't want to buy Chinese goods. So China is supposed to be a friend of Iran, but in fact is doing a lot of harm to Iranian economy. Russia, on the other hand, is playing a diabolical game with Iran. They have three objectives. The first objective is to prevent Iran from entering the international gas market as a rival. Because don't forget that the Russians have the biggest reserves of natural gas in the world, and the Iranians have the second biggest reserves of natural gas in the world. At the moment, Europe is held to ransom by Russia because of the gas supplies. If Iran enters the gas market and supplies Europe, Mr. Putin will lose the biggest arm it has at the moment against Western Europe and the European Union as a whole. At the same time, the Russians don't want Iran to become their rival in oil pipelines, you know, from the Caspian Sea bases, from Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and so on, which is, you know, the shortest route to world markets would be through Iran. The Russians want to have a monopoly of all these oil pipelines. They have already lost in one case to China and in another case to Azerbaijan and Turkey. They don't want to lose others to Iran. So, you know, they have been promising a lot of things to Iran, but never delivered it. For example, they promised a credit line of $5 billion to Iran. It hasn't materialized after 2 years. They refuse to sell Iran the warplanes that they are ready to sell even to India, but not to Iran. They find excuses all the time. They promised to let Iran open a branch of Imam Khomeini University in Moscow. Then they reneged on it. It hasn't happened, whereas the same Imam Khomeini University has opened branches in 13 other countries. The Russians promised to abolish visas for Iranians traveling to Russia. They refused to do so. And even during the World Cup football or soccer World Cup, they kept the number of Iranians who wanted to go and support their team during those games to a minimum. More importantly, you know, there is only one city in Russia which is, has a majority of Shiite Muslims, and that is the city of Darband in the Republic of Dagestan. And of course, the Islamic regime, being supposedly the vanguard of Shiism and things like that, wanted to set up a cultural office there and send mullahs to train their clerics. And the Russians have told them, you can go everywhere except there. So, you know, this comes against the background of 200 years of enmity with Russia. You know, we have had four or five major wars with Russia since the 19th century. The Russians detached large chunks of Iranian territory. At the moment, they dominate the Caspian Sea. They have turned it into a military lake by putting a war flotilla there. They don't have any... the Iranians have no love lost for the Russians, and the Russians reciprocate this dislike. So what the Russians want to do is to keep the present situation going in order to keep the United States away from Iran. Because if Iran and the United States become allies, then who would look at Russia in the region? Because Russia may have nuclear weapons and so on, but it is not culturally attractive. The United States is culturally attractive. The United States is technologically attractive. The United States is economically attractive. Even if you go to Tehran now, you know, you see lots of American products, American technology, even Kentucky Fried Chicken under a different name. But there is nothing Russians, because the Russians have nothing to sell except arms. So, you know, it is in Russia's interest to maintain this tension between Iran and the Western powers, especially the United States, in order to make a comeback, as President Putin hopes, in what he regards as Russia's backyard. And he has started doing so in Syria. I think this strategy is doomed to failure, and it will be bad even for Russia. But for the time being, this is the game he's playing.
Thank you. And now to our last caller.
Okay,
Bonnie?
Thank you.
But not least.
Not least. Yes.
Okay, caller, go ahead when you hear your line is unmuted.
That's it. So I'm going to ask a skeptic question. In the 39 years of the Iranian Republic, Islamic Republic, I'm sorry, they have changed course strategically only on three occasions, and each time it was involved military action or threat of military action. One was Reagan. When he came to power, they released the diplomats fearing American action. Saddam Hussein bombarded Iran with heavy chemical weapons, which forced Khomeini to agree to drink the poison chalice, as he said, and agree to ceasefire. And the third one is with 500,000 American coalition forces in Kuwait. Iran was caught red-handed in reaching uranium in Natanz, and an accident in Parchi forced them to pause their nuclear program. All of these three involved military action. Today, the sanctions are not involving any military threat. Do you think they could be successful? Thank you.
Well, you know, the second example you gave was not like that. You know, the Khomeini decided to drink the chalice of poison, or the cup of poison, as he described it, after the naval battle between the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Navy on 18th April 1988. And that naval battle has entered, you know, American naval history. It is taught, you know, at your military colleges as one of the five major naval battles fought by the United States. And the U.S. Navy sank the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Navy, and that was the reason why Mr. Khomeini backed down, not Saddam Hussein, because the war with Saddam Hussein had started in 1980. And the Islamic Republic had just continued fighting. But you are right, you know, this kind of regime stops only when it hits something hard. But we have seen it in other cases too. For example, why did China under Mao Zedong change course after, you know, the series of defeats they suffered at the hands of the Russians, you know, the Soviets at the time, because of, you know, the fight between the Maoists and the revisionists, you know, in the along the Ussuri River and so on. Suddenly the Chinese realized that, you know, if they fight on two fronts, you know, against the U.S. And against Russia, against the Soviet Union, they cannot continue the regime. So, you know, there was, they hit something hard, they stopped. We have seen it in the case of the Soviet Union itself. They were defeated in Afghanistan with tens of thousands of casualties, and they had to change course. They changed course. We have seen it in the case of President Sadat, you know, the famous peacemaker. He was defeated in the Ramadan War with General Sharon's forces breathing down his neck in Cairo. He had to accept to change course. But in the case of Iran, I don't think that we need military intervention. Maybe, you know, what they call proximity pressures may be necessary, which means, you know, the exerting some military pressure without, you know, invasion and without full military action. For example, the UN National UN Security Council resolutions allow for the inspection of ships carrying goods to Iran to see if they are carrying dual purpose products or not. Iranian planes could be landed and searched. You know, these kind of things, that all the instruments exist, but President Obama vetoed all of that. At one point, this kind of pressure could be used. But the risk at that time would be, in my opinion, that the Islamic Republic will just put its tail between its legs and come to the negotiating table, would demand secret negotiations, as they did with Obama, and do a tactical retreat and hope for the best. You know, in the clerical Shiite tradition, they call this going from one column to another, so that you get opening after tightening. You know, in Arabic it is faraj ba'da shidda, and they have been practicing this all the time. The only way to deal with it is not to fall in that trap again.
Excellent. Well, we've come to the end of our marathon session, and the Middle East Forum is exceptionally grateful to Mr. Tahiri for being so generous with his time and sharing his insights with us. We also want to express our thanks to all of our callers for participating, and this concludes our conference call.
I can see. Bommel, hoorspelserie naar de verhalen van Martin Toonder in de bewerking van Peter Tenuil. Kitty Courbois vertelt De Wadem. Bijna 30 jaar geleden werd het nu volgende verhaal over heer Bommel en de Wadem geboren. Toen maakten we ons nog weinig zorgen over de kwaliteit van onze levenslucht. Ach, hadden we maar beter op de ademnood van Hokus Pas gelet en naar Martin Toonder geluisterd.
Heer Bommels levensvreugde is dikwijls wat gedrukt als de bladeren gaan vallen. Maar dit najaar was het erger dan anders. Alle dagen zat hij voor de haard te luisteren naar het klagen van de wind in de schoorsteen. Terwijl Joost hem vergeefs trachtte op te beuren met het wereldnieuws. Tevens had hij dokter Baboon ontboden, die de heer Bommel onderzocht.
Dit is niet in orde. Zwartgalligheid, zou ik zeggen, hoewel kolendamp niet uitgesloten is. Of misschien zit het dieper?
Het is mijn innerlijk. Dat zit vol met diepe gedachten die ik vergeten ben. Ja. Zodat ze me de keel uithangen.
Juist, ja. Oligofrenische alliëntatie is inderdaad niet uitgesloten. Och, we worden allemaal een dagje ouder, nietwaar?
Maar ik ben in de kracht van mijn leven. En met olinatie heb ik niks te maken.
Oh, kalm maar. We zullen het nog even aanzien. Wat u nodig hebt is veel beweging in de frisse lucht. Maar u kunt beter niet alleen uitgaan.
Nee.
Begeleiding is in uw toestand wenselijk. Denk daar vooral aan. Goedendag.
Een dagje ouder. Ik heb helemaal geen toestand en ik houd ook niet van begeleiding. Een heer gaat alleen zijn eenzame weg, dat weet iedereen. Wie zou ik trouwens mee moeten nemen als ik mij in de frisse lucht ga bewegen in dit weer? Tom Poes natuurlijk. Oh, frisse lucht. Maar nu ben ik toch vergeten om Tom Poes mee te vragen. Zal mijn geheugen werkelijk achteruit gaan? Ach, wat, het is heel gewoon om niet overal aan te denken als men veel aan het hoofd heeft. Aan de andere kant is het vervelend genoeg dat ik het vergeten ben. Want ik ben de weg een beetje kwijt. Dit zijn de zwarte bergen, geloof ik. En hier is het klimaat niet goed wanneer men in een toestand verkeert. Zodat ik de weg naar Bommeldam wil weten. Rommelstein, bedoel ik.
Zijn getop bleef niet onopgemerkt. In de beschutting van een bergwand zat een grijzaard, Hokus P. Pas geheten, die de cirkelbewegingen van de oude schicht oplettend volgde. Toen hij dat een poosje had gedaan, stond hij op en haalde een flesje kluts uit zijn ransel.
Oh, een knoeier. Maar hij is beter dan niets. Ik zal hem kracht afnemen, zodat ik verder kan gaan. Want ik ben een uitgeputte oude man met nog maar een klein beetje kluts. Als dat nu maar genoeg is om de levensadem van die sukkel te vangen, dan kan ik weer even voort.
Met die woorden hield hij het dampende flesje onder zijn neus en snoof begierig. Nu voltrok zich een grote verandering aan de grijzaard en de eerste die daar kennis mee maakte was heer Olly. Die had eindelijk gemerkt dat het rondrijden om de rotspiek hem niet verder bracht, zodat hij ten einde raad een andere weg insloeg. Maar op dat moment trad er van achter de stenen een donkere figuur tevoorschijn die streng de hand ophief.
Bergpolitie!
Oh.
Mag ik vragen waarom je zo stuurloos rijdt, meneertje?
Ik...